From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
Although we did not find clear evidence that Secretary Clinton or her colleagues intended to violate laws governing the handling of classified information, there is evidence that they were extremely careless in their handling of very sensitive, highly classified information.
That was FBI Director James Comey Tuesday at a press conference announcing that he would not recommend prosecution of Democratic presidential hopeful Hillary Clinton for using a series of private email servers to conduct State Department business when she was Secretary of State.
For example, 7 email chains concern matters that were classified at the top secret special access program at the time they were sent and received. Those chains involve Secretary Clinton both sending emails about those matters and receiving emails about those same matters. There is evidence to support a conclusion that any reasonable person in Secretary Clinton's position or in the position of those with whom she was corresponding about those matters should have known that an unclassified system was no place for that conversation. In addition to this highly sensitive information, we also found information that was properly classified as secret by the U.S. intelligence community at the time it was discussed on email. That is, excluding any later up-classified emails. None of these emails should have been on any kind of unclassified system, but their presence is especially concerning because all of these emails were housed on unclassified personal servers, not even supported by full-time security staff, like those found at agencies and departments of the United States government, or even with a commercial email service like Gmail.
Attorney Mara Verheyden Hilliard, co-founder of the Partnership for Civil Justice, said it was a highly unusual response from the FBI and one of a highly unusual series of events.
It's a remarkable week of events. You have a week ago Monday with Bill Clinton inadvertently, accidentally running into Loretta Lynch and visiting her airplane in Phoenix. And then by Friday, Loretta Lynch, the attorney general, announcing that while she won't recuse herself from the case, she will now accept whatever recommendation is given to her by the FBI. Saturday morning, Secretary Clinton sits for what her office was calling a voluntary interview with the FBI on this issue for 3 hours. And then yesterday morning, the first business day after that interview, before noon, we have Comey coming out and announcing that he does not believe that she has broken any law. It is extraordinarily fast. It is highly unusual. And it is remarkable to see that the Justice Department could so carefully evaluate her interview, analyze it against the other interviews that they've done, look at her statements in the other interviews against all of the evidence of this investigation for these years, and before noon on the first business day, Tuesday morning, announce that it's all fine.
Even more unusual was the fact that within hours, President Obama was out campaigning with the former Secretary of State.
Hillary Clinton has been tested. She has seen up close what's involved in making those decisions. And there has never been any man or woman more qualified for this office than Hillary Clinton.
But aside from the blatant display of partisan politics involved, there are deeper concerns, as Verheyden Hilliard explains.
I think there's a critical phrase here in James Comey's statement that that people need to be aware of, which is he goes through, he indicates that there's some evidence, but in the end, he's saying that a prosecutor wouldn't bring this case. And the reason that he points to, among the reasons he points to, is the phrase he uses is that there were no indications of disloyalty, unquote, to the United States. So it's very interesting. That's not written into anything anywhere, but that's an open definitional statement that basically means if you were a whistleblower and the U.S. government then determined that that's disloyal to tell the truth to the American people about what the government is doing when the government tries to hide it, then you're getting prosecuted, like John Kerouac, like Chelsea Manning. But if you are doing the same acts like Secretary Clinton, and James Comey decides that there are not, quote-unquote, indications of disloyalty, And then if you're violating the statute in word, it doesn't matter.
Even with the apparent go-ahead from the head of the FBI, it's apparently not smooth sailing for the Clinton campaign quite yet. As the major party conventions draw near, a legal battle is shaping up for the DNC in Philadelphia that could determine who ends up being the Democratic nominee and could also leave some high-level Democratic National Committee members and the committee itself writing some very large checks. Last Thursday, a group of more than 60 plaintiffs filed a federal lawsuit in Florida's Southern District against the Democratic National Committee and outgoing DNC Chair Deborah Wasserman Schultz, alleging, among other things, that they and millions of other donors to the Bernie Sanders campaign were fraudulently induced to donate based upon repeated public assertions by committee members and Wasserman Schultz herself that the primary process was being fairly conducted by them, a promise the plaintiffs say was false. They allege that the DNC and Wasserman Schultz made the false statements to induce the class of Sanders donors to give their money. They seek both the return of that money and treble damages. The estimated cost given was about $3 billion. Here in New York, another group of Sanders supporters, in this case 22 Sanders delegates, brought a petition to New York State Supreme Court, New York County Friday, seeking, among other things, to void the appointment of New York Governor Andrew Cuomo as the chair of the New York delegation to the Democratic Convention. They also seek to have the court intervene directly in the DNC's appeal process, taking up the matter. Nationally, there have been challenges brought alleging wrongdoing of a varied nature. Of particular note was the vector between exit polling data in the Democratic primaries across the country at odds with the officially reported vote, in some cases, by almost 25%. The U.S. State Department, when monitoring elections elsewhere in the world, considers those with a vector of 5% or greater between exit polls and official results suspicious and will not certify. This was veteran election lawyer and political science professor Bob Fitrakis speaking with CPR Metro last month.
In at least 12 states, there's clear evidence that Sanders prevailed in those states and that the vote was manipulated. But we do know statistically, the results don't make any sense. People are coming out in these exit polls. The international benchmark, the gold standard, so to speak, for rigged elections. And in 12 of these states, California being another one, but really Alabama, Missouri, Massachusetts, here in Ohio, Clinton unexpectedly gets 9 percentage points more than she should. In all those states, if they weren't on U.S. territory, if they were foreign nations, our State Department would not certify that election as valid and democratic.
As volatile as the political landscape has been in the United States over this election season, the situation in Europe seems even more unstable. We spoke with Dr. Richard Wolff, professor of economics, who just returned from a trip to Europe via Skype Tuesday.
Well, it was a very interesting 2.5 weeks that I spent there, mostly in Paris, and it is really nothing short of historic what's going on. The British vote to leave the European Union gets a lot of attention, and it's a historic moment, and so it's worth some comment. And the very different struggles going on in the streets of Paris are equally historic, but in a different way, and together they speak to a breakdown in the post-World War II configuration of Europe that is likely to have major consequences in Europe and far beyond. And though I was not there in Italy, within this week, after Brexit and after the struggles in Paris, the Italian banking system has pretty much collapsed, and the Italian government is in a historic struggle trying to figure out whether to bail out its defunct banks, bail in, which is a new concept maybe we should talk about. But clearly, the troubles in Europe are now no longer stories of small economies like Ireland or Greece or Portugal. They're now more and more about the powerhouses of Europe, Britain, Italy, Spain, and finally France and Germany itself. So let me start with Brexit. Much has been written, so I'm not going to go over that. Suffice it to say, in my judgment, looking at it all, this was really not a vote about whether you want to stay in the European Union or not. In other words, it was about that on the surface. But what people were doing in the votes they cast was quite different. They participated in this election because it was a way to express their anger, their upset, their criticisms, and not because this was really the issue that they would have preferred to vote about. So, for example, it's clear that the mass of the British people, having been inundated in the weeks and months before this vote by David Cameron, the Prime Minister, and by virtually the entire political and corporate elite of the United Kingdom, who are all, with very few exceptions, pushing to stay inside the European Union, to keep things as they were, that this was a chance for the mass of the British people, a clear majority, to put thumbs down, to say, we don't trust you, we don't like you, we don't believe you, and if you say for we should do X, we're going to do not X. It had nothing to do, in my judgment, for most of the voters, with any worked out notion of what the pros and cons were in some reasoned basis to stay in or to leave. Indeed, both sides of the race understood it. And so both sides in the weeks and months leading up produced advertisements whose level of hype rival anything we do here in the United States. Wild descriptions of the calamity that would befall on Britain if they did whatever it is the payer for these ads didn't want them to do. Each side outdoing the other in the most fantastic predictions that made no sense, had no grounding other than a wild speculation of what might under a scenario happen. So for me, the interesting question is, why did so many British people decide to vote against the people who run their country, the people whom they voted into office not that many years ago, the Conservative Party, et cetera, et cetera? And I don't think the answer is at all difficult to find. The real wages, the average real wages in Britain today are what they were a dozen years ago. It's as if an entire decade of British history blew by the British people and gave them, in response to hard work, nothing. No extras, no increase in the standard of living. They were asked to work harder. They were asked to work with fewer job benefits. They were asked to work with greater job insecurity. They were asked to live with austerity-driven cutbacks in public service. They were asked to lower their standard of living. I shouldn't say asked. They were forced to lower their standard of living. And in exchange, they got absolutely nothing. Their real wages are lower, as well as all the other supports of their lives, worse. It is no surprise that while they might have thought that was necessary for a couple of years, while they might have bought the conservative line that this was a necessary medicine to fix the problem and to resume the prosperity, they are now 10 to 12 years in, quite clear in their minds that this resumption of prosperity is not around the corner and may not be there for decades to come. And they're angry, and they feel betrayed, and they feel lied to, and they took that out on the people who run British society. It was, in short, a perfectly reasonable thing to do, even if you believe that in some way, and no one can know this, staying in the European Union would be somehow marginally better than going outside of it. That is at best a guess and a speculation, and in no way strong enough to counteract the accumulated anger and rage. It's a little bit like, and has the same roots as, people voting against the Republican Party establishment for Mr. Trump, against the Democratic Party establishment for Mr. Sanders, and there are many other examples as well. Last, for a rational British working class person, they are looking at a conservative government before this vote that is imposing austerity on them, cutting government programs, cutting government benefits, lowering the standard of living in terms of the quality, the quantity, and the payment they get for their jobs. They are being squeezed. And when they look across the English Channel to the leadership of the rest of Europe, it is committed to the same austerity policies that the British leadership is. So the question is, why would you want to go one way or the other? Because either move could just as well be from the frying pan into the fire as not doing it. And so again, with the uncertainty there, with the similarity of what is happening on both sides, the need, if you like, to stick your nose up, to put your thumb down at the people running British society was far the most powerful persuader of how people voted on that day. And I think that this is common in history. Big moments of change happen, not because people have a clear idea of where they want to go, but they have a very clear idea of where they don't want to stay. And when revolutions happen, it's usually because the status quo is unbearable, not because there's a clear blueprint for where to go next. And I think this kind of a vote played that same role. This was an opportunity for the accumulated rage, bitterness, and disappointment of the mass of the British people, or at least of a large portion of them, to vent their anger. This does not deny that there were particular groups that had other grievances which they wove into this as best they could. Those who look for scapegoats, scapegoats like immigrants, or scapegoats like big business, or scapegoats like you fill in the blank. Those folks are always there. They're beating their drum. If they thought it would help them to vote one way or another in this election to pursue their objectives, they did that too. But to look at them and to think they were what drove this situation is, I believe, a mistake. Immigrants have been an important part of British economy now for a long time. Yes, it's true that Eastern Europeans have come recently, but they're on top of others. And while they might be an additional problem, they are also of the same white skin and of the same religious backgrounds, et cetera, and so represent in some ways less of a problem for the British people than the African and Asians who have been coming before. And so I think, again, this is a statement that the last decade of capitalism, global capitalism, has damaged so many people, has delivered not only not the goods, but the bads, with more coming down the pike, whether it's the indebtedness of your children to get a college education, or your lousy job, or your cutback public services. It's become too much, and the anger is splitting the support for the old traditional parties, and new faces, new parties, and new political commitments are the order of the day. Let me turn to France. Because France is the same story, but in a different configuration. Here we have the following. A socialist government, that is, the Socialist Party, prevails both in the president's office, François Hollande, and in the National Assembly. Only the Senate, which is a junior partner in government, is not controlled by the socialists. So they have an extraordinary amount of political power, and they came to that position. They won the last national elections handsomely by promising that there would be no more austerity in France, probably the most popular single platform upon which François Hollande ran, was that the day after he came into power, he would hire 4,000 new French school teachers, a demonstration that his regime would not cut back public services, but the opposite, and that he would tax the rich and so forth. Not only has very little come of that, not only has austerity prevailed in France, but a few months ago, Mr. Hollande, suffering badly in the polls precisely because he did not deliver on what he promised, made a remarkable decision. He would introduce a new labor law. And the idea behind this labor law has been an idea floated by the right-wing half of French politics for 50 years. And for that matter, by right-wingers in the United States, people like Cameron in England, and lots of others. The idea goes like this. Our economy could produce lots more jobs and prosperity if only you made it easier for businesses to hire and fire workers, if you got rid of the regulations that are strangling the labor market. This kind of language is used. So Mr. Hollande, like so many other European socialists, having been captured by this way of thinking, decided to fool everybody by coming up with his own version of how to deregulate, or if you like, reform the labor market in England. And the bill he proposed, it's actually not a bill because he was afraid to submit a bill to the assembly because even his own socialist party would have rebelled. So it's actually a presidential order to get around the problem of not getting support in the legislature. That's how he did it initially anyway. This bill or this proposal allows employers in France to hire and fire much more easily. It allows them to get around rules and regulations that protect workers' job security, protections won by workers over decades of often bitter struggles. It allows different and lower rates of overtime pay, a whole bunch of things that the employers of France have wanted and which they applauded, although they were hesitant since they want even more of that than Hollande's proposal allowed. On the other side of the political fence, the labor unions in France, the young people of France looking to enter the labor market saw this for what it was, a direct attack on their economic well-being. And this at a time when they're already upset and bitter about years of austerity, resulting from a collapse of capitalism they take no responsibility for, a bailout of the biggest banks who brought the crisis, a bailout that bypassed working people and students, who instead got the austerity to allow the government to pay back the borrowing it did to bail out the banks and the big corporations. It's really too much in the minds of French, the left half of French politics. But here is the more profound historical reality. Mr. Hollande proposed a change in the labor market that hurt the interests of the people whose votes got him into office. He produced a change in labor rules that served the interests of the people in France who opposed his effort to become president. It's astonishing. And what's worse is that in the streets of Paris, where it was first the students who, as so often, took the leadership and formed a movement called Nuit Debout, which is French for up all night, because the students stayed up all night protesting in major squares and intersections of Paris against this horrific law. Now it isn't the students so much that are in charge. It's the CGT, which is the largest confederation of labor unions in France. And they're now spearheading, organizing, and supporting selective strikes and demonstrations, all against Hollande's proposal for labor reform. And now you see almost nightly on French television, the socialist government calling in the state and local police who are seen beating up student and workers protesting peacefully, by the way, most of the time, the labor law. My humble opinion, this is the self-destruction of French socialism. It's following the path of exactly what happened to the Greek Socialist Party, which was once one of the two major parties, having its own leaders become the prime minister of Greece repeatedly in the last 30 years. That's now a party that barely gets 3% of the vote in recent elections in Greece. They collapsed. They lost everything. When they campaigned to be the opponent of austerity, won the election on that basis, and immediately turned around to impose austerity on the very people who voted them in to do the opposite. The end result is people in Greece are disgusted by it all. They turn away from politics altogether, some of them. They formed Syriza or joined it because they wanted to move to the left because the Socialist Party was no longer a left-wing affair. Or they quit in disgust and said, if you're going to be a right-wing party, well, we might as well join the right wing rather than have you as a weak copycat of the right. And that's the end of the Greek Socialist Party. And the French Socialist Party is doing the same. In the long historical sweep, that is just as disruptive of Europe as voting for Brexit is and is going to be on the part of what the British did. The difference, or maybe even the similarity, is this. The socialists, the left wing, have in both England and France, and for that matter across Europe, have for a long time not been what they once were, not the opponents of capitalism as the system, not the advocates for a new and different system. They gave that up, many of them in the 50s and 60s. And what they became instead was advocates for a softer, gentler capitalism. One that combined dominance for big corporation with sets of government rules and regulations, providing a safety net, a welfare program, free medical insurance for everybody, subsidized housing, and so on. This is no longer affordable, say the capitalists of Western Europe. We can't do that anymore. And so the socialists are left with the inability to deliver a softer, gentler capitalism. Or to say it the same way, what's softer and gentler is becoming less and less different from what's harsh and tough. The socialists don't look like they're all that different from the conservatives who have a tough capitalism commitment. And what's happening is the mass of people are no longer impressed by that difference. They really want an alternative to the capitalism that is shafting them, and the socialists are no longer able to present themselves as that, so that the left in Europe is searching for a new direction, a new paradigm, new political parties, and there is a growing gap between the leaderships of the traditional old parties and where the masses of people are going. Just like in the United States, you see the growing interest in the Trumps and the Sanders, and the disappearing interest in the Bush family, the Clinton family, and what is representing the same old, same old.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.